Those fans who fall away when times get tough. All y'all better be watching Rangers tomorrow, or after last night's loss, we don't need any bandwagon fans at the moment. Last night was tough enough as it was. Honestly, I was thinking about that last night, just in the sense of, you know, going through those highs and those lows of that. Sports is funny in that way, of its constant reminder of what success can look like, what failure can look like. And I think about that mostly in terms of what that also means then for us as we kind of navigate life. And as we've been talking about this series, we're in the last week of this series where we're called Jesus Preaches, where we're looking at all these different sermons that Jesus himself preached. What becomes clear is that there is this common through line of, like, times are going to be difficult in this. It's not always going to be quote unquote easy. How do you respond in it? Last week, we specifically talked about what it looked like to walk this narrow path, that it was very clear that Jesus said, if you're going to follow me, this is the direction that you have to go. This is how you have to actually live and operate. And when you hear that kind of thing, when you hear, in order to follow me, you have to go down this path, you have to be doing X, Y, Z, there's a question that pops into my mind. And frankly, it's the same question that I think about when I'm talking to a car salesman, or when there's somebody at my house doing work, or that time that I got accidentally swindled into a timeshare presentation in Mexico at a resort, which is, okay, yeah, but what is all this gonna cost me? All right, because when you think about the idea of you're gonna have to follow Jesus, it does come with some sort of cost. What are you going to have to actually give up in order to follow Christ in some capacity? The great news is following Christ does have a cost, but it is better than that of a timeshare. There's no blackout weekends. You can go anytime you want with Jesus, which is fantastic. But more importantly, that Jesus actually even has this expectation that each and every one of us aren't even going to walk away from that deal. That each and every one of us can and should follow this path and pay this cost of what it means to follow Christ. And the way that he outlines this idea that every single person should do this is by making it clear when some of his disciples actually start talking to him about what they have to do and what they might have to give up. And it says in the book of Matthew, it says, when Jesus saw the crowd around him, he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake. Then a teacher of the law came to him and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Jesus replied, "Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." Another disciple said to him, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." Jesus told him, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." Now, every time I read that, and not every time you read that, or if this is the first time you've ever heard that passage before, you probably are thinking what I usually think, which is, Jesus kind of sounds like a jerk there, and I don't know that I like him very much. And if you're afraid that you're going to say that, I'm saying it right now, because he does kind of sound like a jerk in that moment, right? Like, you've got a guy whose dad has died, and all he's doing is saying, all right, let me go bury my father, which is a Jewish tradition, by the way, and then I'll follow you. And Jesus is like, get over it, leave your dead father and come and follow me. Now, the problem with that mentality of when we read that at face value is we lose the importance of tone and context that were present when these were first given, these testimonies of Jesus. Because the first testimonies of Jesus weren't given in written form. They were given as an oral presentation. A guy would walk into a town square, people would gather around, and he would recount the entire gospel according to Matthew. He was Matthew. And he would give that entire testimony of what happened. And so what's so important in that is that you hear more of tone and context when you think about it in that manner. And most scholars will agree that, like, contextually speaking, the way that this is written, the way that this would have been presented, is that more than likely what was actually happening is that this guy's dad hadn't died. This guy was saying, well, you know, like, my dad's here and I gotta be here for my dad. And then, but you know, once he dies, I'll bury him and then I'll come and follow you. And Jesus is like, no. You're either going to do this or you're not. But even if all those scholars kind of have that wrong, and even if this guy, dad, truly had died, and he really was only saying, like, oh, I just need like a day or 2 days or something like that, what is lost, again, is tone. And the tone that this guy would have had in this time would have been the same tone that you or I have, right? When that neighbor from down the street that you don't like that much is like, we should go to dinner this week. And you're like, I don't know if I'm kind of busy this week. Maybe like, let me go do X, Y, Z, and then we'll do that another time, because you're just trying to get an excuse to get out of it. And that's what this guy is doing. This guy's just looking for any excuse that he can come up with to get out of actually following Christ. And Christ is just like, listen, let the dead bury their dead. If you actually want to do this, you'll do this. But the where this gets to is this guy doesn't actually want to do this. What he had in his mind was this vision of what his life was going to look like. And he couldn't get over the fact that if he was going to follow Christ, his life was going to now look differently. And he wanted to hold on to that original image. He didn't want to let go of what he used to have. Do y'all remember, this is going to get back to Jesus, I promise, but do y'all remember when in 2011 Game of Thrones came out? That was a wild time. Game of Thrones was fantastic. It was an amazing show. In an age of streaming, it was a water cooler show. Like, it was the type of show that people would reorient their Sunday calendars around. They'd be like, I can't go out to dinner tonight. We got Game of Thrones tonight, and I want to be able to talk about it tomorrow morning with my coworkers. So they would DVR it. They would reorient their calendars around it, and it was this massive pop culture phenomenon. That was one of the biggest shows that has ever existed in mankind. And for context, to actually prove just how big this was, between the years of 2016 and 2018, in a 3-year period, there were over 12,000 couples who named their children after a Game of Thrones character. That is 11 children a day, like 11 children a day. One every other hour is being named Jon Snow or something like that, because this show was so absolutely massive. And then we all got to, and I watched every second of it. I loved it. I was like, this is amazing. And then we get to the last season. And the last season was absolute pile of garbage, flaming garbage at that. It was like the worst thing that it was offensive. I'm still not over it, if you can tell. It was absolutely horrific just how bad it was. And the funny thing about that is I watched the first episode of that last season and I knew it was going to be terrible. Like, after that, I was like, this is going to be a rough ending. They're not going to stick the landing on this. And you know what I did? I watched every single episode of that thing, and y'all did too. So don't judge, because all of us did it. And why did we do it? Because we'd already watched the other 7 seasons. What are we going to do? Bail out now? No, we're going to go through, we're going to grit our teeth, and we're going to do a thing that we know is not good, that is no longer enjoyable, all under the pretense of, well, it used to be good, so I still want to have it. This is known as the sunk cost fallacy. This is a very real thing, both in our lives and in like the business world. This is the, well, I can't bail out of a show now, even though it's bad, because I've already put in all this time. I can't pivot now. This is also seen like in the actual, like if in an automotive industry, right? They can be designing a car. They know it's not going to be a good car. Everybody sees the writing on the walls. Everybody knows this is going to go terrible. Everybody knows you should just stop. And what they do is they keep going because they have told themselves, well, we've already invested X, Y, Z. It would be foolish to stop now. When in reality, it's the only wise decision. If they did a true, actual, like cost-benefit analysis and objectively evaluated it, the idea becomes very clear what they should be doing in that situation. Now, admittedly, cost-benefits analysis is a accounting term. I took one class, Accounting 209. I did get an A in that, shout out. But also, I remember literally 0 of that class. So for any accountants in the room, I'm very sorry for about how I'm about to butcher the idea of cost-benefit analysis. But effectively, this is the way it works. You look at all of the costs that are associated with producing something, with going down a path. Everything. And you have to be truthful about what it's going to actually take. All right. And so that's expensive. That's overhead. That's everything associated with taking path A versus path B. Then you have to look at all the benefits. And again, you have to be very truthful and honest about everything that you are going to get out of it. And once you do that, you get an objective thing that ultimately just gives you a final number that makes it clear which path that you should take. The way that you should look at this is this idea of when we are looking at what Jesus was talking about, that when you look at just things from a very clear, objective standpoint, there are very clear understood costs and there are very clear understood benefits of what it means to follow Christ. And what this guy in this story was doing was operating off this assumption of, yeah, but you don't understand. I've got all this background. I've got all this history. I've got all this baggage, so can't pivot now. And Jesus is like, listen, it's very simple. It's very simple. Not easy, but it's simple. Because Jesus minces no words when it actually comes to what it means to what the costs and the benefits are going to look like. Because he says this later in the book of Matthew, when he says, then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life, benefit, will lose it, cost. But whoever loses their life for me, and for the gospel, we'll save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. What is the cost? You pick up your cross, you follow him. What's the benefit? Soul. We hear that phrase often. You probably have, if you've really been around church, pick up your cross and follow me. It's one of those phrases where, like, in a more modern understanding, we think it's more poetic because we're like, oh my gosh, Jesus got up on a cross. He's saying we should pick up our cross. That's beautiful. But you have to understand that at that time, Jesus hadn't died yet on a cross. So, like, people wouldn't have understood him in that way. What they would have understood, though, is what the cross was. Because as beautiful as the thing is, and now, like, athletes, right, like, they wear chains with crosses on, it's wonderful. At the time, it was not a hope-filled symbol. It was literally a device used to torture and kill people. It would have been the equivalent if I was wearing a necklace right now with an electrocution chair or, like, a lethal injection at the bottom of it, right? Like, that's what it was. And the phrase, take up your cross, had a very specific meaning because once you were sentenced to death and you were to be put to death on a cross, what they would make you do is they would make you go from the courthouse to your place of execution. And what that would look like was you literally picking up a cross and carrying it to your own death. When Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me, he is making it very clear to people, you are going to have to die for this. And you're going to need to do it willingly. The literal definition of sacrifice. This is the cost that he was talking about with people. It is what I mean when he says he did not mince words. He made it very abundantly clear that if you were going to follow him, if you were going to walk this path, the cost of discipleship was sacrifice of your own life and doing it willingly. We hear that. And it feels horrific. It feels daunting. But the truth is, each and every one of us does have some facet of our lives that we have to give up. And we know it. Very few of us are ever going to walk in the church, hear a sermon that actually teaches us for the first time something that we shouldn't be doing. Very rare is that. Like, very few people come into church and hear a preacher be like, hey, you shouldn't cheat on your spouse. And they're like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. What they need is they need it to be reframed in their mind. But if I were to say right now, imagine for a second that facet of your life that you need to sacrifice, that you need to give up, the piece of your past that you're holding on to, the thing that you are carrying alongside you, that you can't carry the cross because you're carrying this. If I say that, what's going to come to mind? What is your cost of discipleship? When we hear that and it's framed in that way, that that's something that we know we do need to give up, we want to push back. In large part because sacrifice is inherently a selfless thing, and humanity, and it's part of the issue of the brokenness of the world, humanity is inherently selfish. We're not inherently selfless. And sacrifice is inherently a selfless ideal, and so we want to push back against it. We don't inherently want to go into it. But the problem with that is when we look at sacrifice in that way, we are overvaluing sacrifice. Because the truth is, we're sacrificing every day as it is. The average human brain makes between 30 and 35,000 conscious decisions a day. 30 and 35,000 conscious decisions, right? If I sit down here, I've decided that I'm going to sit down, which means I have now made the decision not to keep standing. That's sacrifice. I've sacrificed this idea of me standing so that I can sit down here. That is all this is. Every time we choose to do A, it means we can no longer do B. That is all sacrifice actually is. Every time that I decide to mow the lawn instead of taking a nap, I am making a sacrificial choice in that moment. In favor of a beautiful yard, I am sacrificing joy. Like, this is the inherent thing. And so when I talk about this, what we're simply being asked to do is to look at what option A is, following Jesus, and choosing that over option B, which is that thing that came to our minds. And I'm sure you're thinking, yeah, but Jimmy, you don't understand what you're asking me to give up. It's going to cost a lot. It's going to be really hard. It's going to be a heck of a lot worse than sitting down or mowing the lawn. Sure. But didn't you hear what Jesus said you were going to get? Your soul. Of course it's going to be a lot. It's this really beautiful quote by Thomas Paine, who, I got to preface, ends up actually being like atheistic by the end of his life, but that's neither here nor there. The quote is beautiful. It says, "What we obtain too cheaply, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Heaven knows how to put a proper price upon its good, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated. Heaven knows how to put a proper price on its good, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom was not highly rated." When we do communion liturgy here, there's this phrase in the traditional liturgy that says that Jesus delivered us from slavery to sin and death, which, like, from a grammatical standpoint is weird because it kind of sounds like Jesus delivered us from slavery and then took us to sin and death. But every time I hear that, I think that's like not written in the best way. But more importantly, I love what he's doing in that sentence because it is actually naming the reality that, like, we are slaves to brokenness and death and sin in this world. There's nothing that we could do to get out of it. That we're beholden to those things that are in our minds, the cost of discipleship. And there's nothing we could have done to get out of it ourselves. And we were slaves to it. And the beauty of it is that Jesus bought us out of slavery. He gave us our souls back. He gave us freedom. He took the burden that was hanging around our neck and he took it off and said, "All you have to do is just let go of it. Give up your life so that you can have your life." Because Jesus lived the most full human life in the history of humanity. He lived the fullness of life, and the exclamation point on it was his willingness to carry his cross and get up on it. And he's asking us to do the same. And I can't stand up here and tell you that, like, at some point, no human in existence isn't going to be asked to do the same thing. The history of the church is filled with martyrs who literally gave their life for the kingdom of God. And I hope that nobody in this room or in this church or in this world ever has to again. But it is a thing that we're asked to do. But more importantly, We're asked to be looking at that thing that came to our minds and sacrificing that and letting go of it. Letting that life die so that we might live eternally. Because when we do that, what's truly actually given to us is love. When you look at humanity, we were created out of love by God. God so loved the world that he created humanity to be in this loving communal relationship with God. And then we kind of, you know, mess the whole thing up. But God never stopped loving us. And a conversation around cost, a conversation around benefit, a conversation around sacrifice would be remiss if it didn't actually involve a conversation around love. Because God so loved the world that he created all of us. And then when we screwed it up, God so loved the world that he gave himself for us. In fact, actually, in the book of John, there's this passage. It says, "Greater love knows no man than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends. For everything that I have learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you so that you might go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, and so that whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you. This is my command, love each other. You are my friends if I do what I command. This is my command, love each other." Sacrifice and love are intrinsically entwined with one another. I think back to my single days before I was married, before I had a kid, and like all I had to really care about was myself. And now that I have a child, now that I have a wife, I'd give anything for them. Truly. If a situation occurred where the only scenario was whether or not I would give my life for them, of course I would do that. There's no question about that. Because I love them so much. And when you realize that, you probably think, well, yeah, of course, that's how love works. And you realize that's what God did for us, because that's the only rational solution. God was willing to sacrifice himself for us out of a sense of love. Because the benefit was relationship with us again. The moment we buy into this idea that the true benefit that we're getting is a fullness of our soul, the true benefit is a fuller understanding and the fullest understanding of living in love in this world, love with each other and love with God, you realize that the sacrifice doesn't outweigh it anymore. It's not that sacrificing can be hard. It's not that we're always going to do it perfectly. But from an objective standpoint, you realize this is always going to outweigh this. It's why the conversation with Christianity gets so messed up sometimes. Because like if you ask college students, like what they did a study, they asked all these college students, hey, what does it mean to be a Christian? 50% of them didn't even mention Jesus. And 75% of them didn't even mention God. Most of them just said, well, you just got to be a good person. And the reality is, if you want me to actually give up my life in order to just be a good person, yeah, that doesn't balance. I'm going to give up my life so that I might actually have full life. I might have my soul again. Yeah, that doesn't balance either, but in a way better way. And the challenge for us this week is to ask ourselves what it might look like to truly live in love with God and in love with others. What are those things in our heads that we are holding on to and it's preventing us from actually letting that old life die because we won't drop it in order to pick up the cross that will actually let us have life, that will actually let us have love? And then do one thing. That pushes you closer to letting that old life die. You don't have to get it done this week, but you do have to start on the path. And if we take every single step, we see the life that Jesus had. We see the life that we're meant to have. We see our souls. Let's pray. Gracious and loving God, you came and you paid the sacrifice. You paid the highest of prices. God, you did it out of love. There was no question in your mind as to whether or not this is something that you ought to do, even though it was difficult. And so, God, I ask for myself, I ask for the people in this room, allow us to do the same. Allow us to see you, to see our life, to see our friends, our neighbors, with that same love that we don't hesitate to sacrifice for. God, empower us to take one step closer. Strengthen us to give us the ability to let go so that we might pick up the cross, how heavy as it might seem, and start following you, knowing that we don't lose our life, God, but actually for the first time, we gain it. It's in your name we pray. Amen.